My name is Paul Hansen, and I teach history at California Lutheran University. It'll be impossible for you to avoid California Lutheran teachers at the moment, because in the next room, one of my colleagues is also giving a session. But the title then of this session is Fundamentalism and Religious Conflict, What is the Future? One of the areas in which historians are absolutely the weakest in is the future. And so I thought, rather than nattering on about my own thoughts here, I'd like a little bit more help here this morning than I've perhaps requested of you previously. Some of you I know have been to a number of the other sessions, others have not. I don't think it makes much difference. But I want us to think about, first of all, what places in the world are currently experiencing, or have within the past decade at least, what are experiencing violence and conflict in which religion seems to play a major role. Certainly one of the phenomena of the last 10 years has been the emergence of religion linked with some kind of militant political ideology that has manifested itself in almost all of the world's major religions. To many people, this seems very incongruous, if not absolutely a denial of what some of these religions might stand for. In the name of religion, throughout history, certainly people have been killed, slaughtered, and maimed, but I think some people, perhaps naively, expected that that time had passed and that we don't do those things anymore in the late 20th century. But certainly, as I say, I think the events of the last decade seem to indicate otherwise. And so I've been interested in looking at this type of revivalism and its link with political violence. If you look around the world, there are a number of such places where obviously we can see that. Maybe we could list some of them on the board. I'll ask you to generate a few.
We'll start out with our own country.
Start out with the U.S.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Oliver North syndrome.
Who was it religion?
Well, yeah, we can maybe talk about it. We'll get it up here. The U.S. has some kind of, I really want to make it extended to beyond conflict in terms of disagreement, but to conflict which sometimes leads to violence. You might argue that some Christian fundamentalists, for example, have linked their stand on abortion to such an extent they've been willing to blow up clinics, for example, or things
of
that
nature.
Or foreign policy.
You know, it's related to foreign policy.
All right. Other?
Ireland.
Ireland. Northern Ireland.
Iran.
Okay. Well, Iran.
Yeah, Iran.
Lebanon.
Yeah. This is a quiz for those who've been here. Which ones we've talked about. These are the easy ones.
Sudan.
That one we haven't talked about, but certainly qualifies. We'll talk about what the conflicts are maybe in a moment in some of these if we haven't. Any others?
Can we say that Southern Soviet Union?
USSR. Yeah.
Uzbekistan.
Yeah, that's right. We'll give the USSR here.
Poland,
possibly. Poland.
Mm-hmm.
India.
South Africa.
South Africa, that'd be an interesting one to talk about. South Africa. Let's.
Egypt.
How about another of the places where we've had a theme this week?
Sri Lanka.
Sri Lanka.
Israel.
That's one. We have the rise of Jewish fundamentalism in Israel.
Indonesia.
And next door, Malaysia, is a place where that's same kind of thing is going on. Others.
Korea, South Korea.
Korea, South Korea. The religious conflict there.
Christian against the
Christian. Yeah, South Korea. Okay. Maybe we're going to have the half the UN membership up here in a moment, huh?
Even in Taiwan, you know, they've put some religious leaders in prison in the past years, but it's on a small scale.
Okay.
So I don't know if you want to put that in there.
Maybe we'll talk about that in a moment. We're running out of space. There are a couple others I do want to get on the board here. What about Lowell here? We're most aware of the recent conflict about democracy, but Tibet in China, especially over the last 10 years, is
Nepal.
And Nepal is another in the region. In Africa, in addition to Sudan, Nigeria has had some real problems in this area.
Ethiopia
has had some. Over in another part of the Philippines. The Philippines has a Muslim separatist movement operating in the south.
You put Somalia there with Ethiopia.
Oh, yeah. Right. Link it up there. Well, we've got a couple more spaces on the board here. Couple of the other places, there are a number of them in the Middle East, of course. One we talked about that has had some conflict is Saudi Arabia.
Their impression on the rest of the countries.
Right. And Syria has had some very violent conflicts. We could put several others, especially a number of the Gulf states, Kuwait, Bahrain, have had Sunni-Shia conflicts, which have been broken into riots. All right, we've got a long list. Now, how do we make sense of this list, which could be enlarged? Are there any kinds of categorizations that we can make about these conflicts that may help us sort them into categories and begin to look at them? As I was jotting down some of these countries and thinking about them last night, I thought maybe one distinction that could be made would be that in some of these countries, the conflicts are allegedly between two different religious groups, Christians versus Muslims in the Sudan, for example, or the Sikhs versus the Hindus in the Punjab in India, for example, or the Buddhists versus Hindus in Sri Lanka. Lebanon divided that way to some degree. Others tend to represent what might be called reforming or purifying movements in the name of a dominant religious tradition that is already within the country. Iran would be, you know, a good example there. Malaysia, the drive toward fundamentalism in Malaysia is at the behest of the Muslim majority there, the Malays, to become more Muslim-like, to become more pure in the faith.
Sudan,
the same. So there's overlapping with these categories. That is part of the religious conflict here. Hindus versus Sikhs and so forth may also then bring forth a more purifying reaction on the part of the group as a way of solidifying the members behind each other in this conflict. But if we look at a number of those conflicts that are between different religious groups, it may be a kind of underlying struggle for power over economic and political questions in which the contesting parties are organized as religious groups, but that initially and sometimes throughout much of the struggle itself, the ideas of the religion are not brought into the conflict. It's simply that this is part of my cultural identity, to identify myself primarily as a member of this religious group, and what we are as a group about here is trying to get our fair share of the pie within this particular national entity. And this may mean, as I say, economic or political power is what they're really after there. With the other kind of movement, the reforming or purifying movement, here the appeals are more overtly religious in the conflict. But here too, I would say, and maybe this is where I'm open to certainly debate and criticism on this one, here too it may be where fundamentalism seems to characterize this type of reform and purifying movement. The concentration of the focus of conflict in the time of the Protestant Reformation was frequently over ideas of religious doctrine. There's the scene, of course, of Luther and Zwingli sitting there in the table and debating about the what really happens here in the Mass. And that was one of the fundamental issues, both with the Church and with the Catholic Church and with the Protestant groups themselves. What you see in many of these reforming movements is not a concentration on ideas or doctrine or an attempt to revive those fundamental ideas of the religion, but more frequently a concern with behavior. Behavior as a sign of godliness, grace, and identity. Public rituals, distinctive dress that may be associated with the religion, or at least its more purifying forms, whether this means donning the veil or dressing more modestly as a woman in Muslim countries, or readopting the Sikh turban or whatever, reimposing diet restrictions, things that publicly show other people that I'm set apart, I'm different from other members in the society, and here are all these external signs and manifestations of it. This seems to be something that characterizes the way in which a lot of these second category of reforming movements work, and I think that's perhaps one of the reasons, too, why they've been labeled fundamentalist. The regulation of public morality to their particular absolute standards, willing and even wanting to apply them to other non-believers or people who don't feel that way, is perhaps another of these characteristics. Whether this is the case because it's easier to monitor behavior rather than ideas, rather than something else. After all, how do you know who's with you? Well, if everybody is dressing the same way or acting the same way in public and morality, this is something that's solidifying it. But who knows what's going on inside people's heads? This may be one of the factors that causes this to be a stress of these particular movements, but it also makes it something that's more susceptible, perhaps, to mobilizing for political purposes. You know, when, again, you get everyone to behave in the same fashion or act in the same way, it's something that mobilizes the masses for popular support of one kind or another for political purposes. Certainly, if you want to take a tie into U.S. fundamentalism, again, we see that many of their particular most important causes are the regulation of certain kinds of public behavior and the imposition of their standards on the whole society and their interpretations. So in some way that might be somewhat similar. I don't know, anyone want to comment or jump in about some of those possibilities here? Yeah, Michael.
Yeah, at least historically, when you brought up the Reformation, it brought to mind that the Reformation and the conflicts there weren't always simply ideas. If we think about the radical Reformation, the left wing, whether that be the Anabaptist or Mincer,
and
you know what we call
the peasant revolt,
sectarians, the peasant revolts, even earlier Christian heresies, so the Montanists and that, ideas and behavior have always been linked together. And I think as we want to distance ourselves from some of those things as the winners and think how nice we are, if it was just a battle with words and ideas, we we mm-hmm. can overlook the blood that sometimes went with it, because there was behavior always attached in actions, controversy, conflict, exile, at times death.
Right, and that's a useful point to make. We can't polarize these out and separate them entirely. I wonder, though, whether the emphasis is fair, in the sense that a number of things that Luther did also, like institute marriage for the clergy, etc., those kinds of behavioral forms were not the kinds of things that people leaped on and jumped on to the degree that they did the doctrinal questions, or right or wrong, I don't know. Were overt changes in behavior, what clergy were allowed to do or not to do, as important or more important. In some of these movements, it appears that that's what's most significant, not bringing back an idea, and how can that idea be manifested in the world? How can we make God active in the world? Well, the almost exclusive answer seems to be, well, we got to dress appropriately. Or we have to insert this particular standard of morality from part of the tradition or whatever. And I think that's a useful point to make, though, that the two are always interrelated. But when we sometimes think of religion, as theologians and others, we're often caught up with the ideas.
Just ideas.
And think, well, this must be a conflict over whether or not the Sikh version of heaven is the appropriate one versus the Hindu one, or something like that. But in fact, it often plays itself out in other ways.
It would seem that in each of these cases that would boil, the conflict boils down to us versus them, for those in the circle as opposed to those outside of the circle.
Yeah,
and the narrowing of a
well, in some ways that both of these do call into another aspect of these conflicts, which is that almost inevitably there's an assertion of one's individual identity and as a member of one's immediate group as being primarily through one's religious affiliation here. That who I am and how I act in the world now is going to be defined by my religious identity. And that's what creates those two circles. If you're in, well, how do I know you're in? And then this becomes the reason we use conduct or behavior to determine that, because now I know you're a friend because you're looking and dressing and acting the same way. I don't know what's going through your mind, but you must be a friend. You must be within the circle. I can't monitor what's going on in your head on the other way. But that sense of identity, assertion of identity, seems to be a part of both of those traditions, whether it's one religion fighting the other for economic and social purposes, or whether you're purifying the faith and reforming it in a way that is going to make a society that's going to work better. A lot of them, or if not most, also seem to have a kind of view of history that is a declining one. They're golden age people. They perceive that there's something wrong in the world today, that it was better in the past, and the way to go and fix it is to go back to the time in the past when it was better, select that golden age, whether it was the age of the Prophet in Medina, the age of the Sikh Empire, Ranjit Singh, or when the Buddhists and the state were closely intertwined in Sri Lanka, or whenever, and reinstitute the same pattern. Emulate that again. And so that also seems to be something that comes through here. Yeah.
Yeah, in line with what you're saying, it's been my observation as my family sailed our boat around the world. We noticed, especially as we sailed up through the Red Sea and in the Middle Eastern countries, this overreaction, which I also see in my own country, the United States, an overreaction to changes that are coming about so rapidly due to primarily technology, that the human mind can't keep up with the technological changes, whether they be the birth control pill or artificial insemination or whatever it might be, irrigation in Egypt or, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And in interviewing, I remember interviewing a naval officer in the port of Sudan. I was taking on fuel there before leaving. And he came right up to me and saw that I was American, flying American flag, and just began to pour out his heart to me how difficult it was for he, a Christian, to live in a Muslim-run country, and how restrictive it was, and how they were overreacting. Of course, Saudi Arabia, with all the money, is putting pressure on all of these countries in the Middle East, or many of these countries in the Middle East, and they were putting a lot of pressure on the Sudan, as well as Egypt and others. But he was most distraught with not being able to live the life that he wanted to live because of the conservatism or the overreaction of his Muslim brothers.
Yeah, that's an excellent point, and maybe a good way to continue the discussion from here, because one of the reasons, what are the reasons why it breaks out in some places and not in others? I mean, there may be other places where there are multiple religious groups in which you yet have not had any kind of revivalism or violence, at least based on religion. There may be other places which haven't experienced purifying revivalist movements, which have aimed at, through sometimes through violence, with changing the existing government or tradition. And I think you're listing one of the conditions. We don't want to go so far as call them causes, but at least there seem to be a set of factors which tend to be associated with the outbreak of religious violence. And certainly one of them is this idea of alienation that you mentioned. Oftentimes produced as a result of rapid social and economic change in a particular society. You lose the sense of roots, of identity, what your culture was. And that seems to be devalued because now the society is going in different directions in which these seem to no longer play any kind of central role. And certainly people who have analyzed the Iranian Revolution have looked upon this as one of the primary causes there. When we talked about the Iranian Revolution in a session here, we pointed out that there was a tremendous increase in oil wealth money that came in the early 70s in Iran, which the Shah proceeded to use in a myriad number of ways to try to make Iran into one of the world's primary military and industrial powers in as rapidly a fashion as possible. And the amount of to use Durkheim's term, anomy, this cultural alienation that took place as a result of that was certainly substantial and caused this kind of extreme reaction back the other way. That's one of the factors that's certainly associated with the Iranian Revolution. And we can see that, I think, particularly in many other Muslim countries too. Those of you who were here for the session on Egypt, that's certainly been a factor in the Islamic revival in Egypt. And we could go on with other places. The Sikhs, we mentioned also, as a result of prosperity in this particular case, wound up changing their lifestyles dramatically. And for conservatives within the tradition, this was an alarm bell that caused them to want to set that whole thing back before it went too far. Perhaps related with it, not quite the same point, but related with it, is a reaction against cultural imperialism. That is, that when these changes are coming in, they're not perceived to be self-generated changes within the society, but something that is imposed from the outside. A westernization model is brought in. Always distinguishing between modernization and westernization, but when it's perceived that the way in which the society is modernizing or changing is following a Western pattern, that can also provoke the reaction just in and of itself.
Vietnam would be an example, right?
Possibly, though there are other kinds of things involved there too, but you're right. Secularism, which often comes in with that kind of a pattern, is something that anybody in a religious tradition becomes worried about. Probably that certainly is the great bête noire of Christian fundamentalists, you know, secular humanism, That's the enemy. It's not other kinds of religious groups, but that's the one. And you have analogous reactions in religious traditions in other countries as well. Sometimes the cultural imperialism is so attractive that it threatens assimilation. Probably the best example there are the Sikhs in India, who, because of the way in which Hinduism works as a kind of amorphous blob that comes out and draws back into it any kind of movement that springs out from it, many Sikhs began to see the danger that they were threatening to become just another Hindu sect and needed to react against that kind of cultural imperialism by clearly demarcating how different they are from Hindus. Another factor, I think, that seems to be associated with these movements frequently is a reaction against an ineffective or corrupt ruler or elite that has not been able to solve the country's basic social, economic, or political problems. A kind of corollary of that would be then the failure of other ideologies to deal with the problems in a country. A characteristic of the newly emergent countries in the third world, the ones who gained their independence after World War II, in the 40s and 50s in Asia and in the 50s and 60s in Africa, is that in almost every case, power was turned over to a westernized, educated elite, sometimes military, sometimes civilian, but all of them, because of their own background in education, because of the way in which they had observed the colonial authorities ruling their countries, tended to emulate those kinds of patterns and ideologies. Okay, if we or reacted against them. For example, if we had a aggressive, capitalistic, exploitive system under colonialism, the answer was socialism. And if we import socialism as an ideology, that will work as we're now newly independent. But in many, many third world countries, various versions of socialism were tried, failed to produce the economic wealth and benefits that people expected. Part of the problem that this elite was dealing with were the very high expectations that people had with political independence. Once we're freed of our colonial shackles, then we will soar like eagles to the top levels of material prosperity. All our problems will be solved simply with political independence. Those expectations were certainly not met, and as a result, secularized elites who tried to lead the country and the westernized or imported ideologies, be they free market capitalism or socialism that they brought in to try to solve the problems, were also discredited. So what's left? People look around the world and say, well, what else can we use? Let's go back to our own tradition, become the answers of some of the fundamentalists. What does an Islamic state mean? Well, a lot of people have no idea, including the people who are advocating it. But they assume somehow that it is going, since it will be under the direction of God, if it's properly instituted, it will result in a far better life for all citizens there. And it's a new ideology that, you know, yet has not yet had a chance to fail. And therefore, like I was saying last week in regard to the Iranian Revolution, I think the Iranian Revolution will continue to be a bellwether for Islamic revivalism now that the war with Iraq is over, because now it will have to produce for its citizens in a way that will make it a demonstrable model that other revivalists can use elsewhere. You see, an Islamic state works. It's more equitable in its distribution of resources. It also stimulates economic growth. It still allows people to be very conservative, perhaps in their social relationships, but all this works together. They've got to prove it.
Without a war to fight, then don't you think that there will be a less tendency for extremism, because they're going to be forced, as you say, to meet the social economic needs of the people. During the war, it was easier to focus everyone on one issue that demanded extremism, that demanded 100% allegiance.
Yeah, that was that was clearly a boon to the preservation of the revolution in the first 10 years. The other thing, though, that will possibly interfere with that scenario is that when any particular interpretation comes along, such as, all right, this is what the Islamic pattern of land distribution is, there can always be people who say, wait a minute now, I don't see this in the Quran. My interpretation of the Islamic pattern follows this particular one, and the fact that you implemented that is obviously means that you've strayed from the path, and I may want to go and oppose you in some fashion or other. Also, if your version of the Islamic state fails, it must mean that God is telling you something. He's not telling you that he doesn't pay attention. God is telling you that you haven't gotten it right. And extremists then who want to oppose that can be, well, you just weren't radical enough in the way in which you went. And so there can still be extremists out on the fringe opposing any Islamic state. This has, in fact, been the pattern in Saudi Arabia, in which they've tried to walk that very thin line between remaining very conservative, they thought, within the Islamic fold, but still being attacked, well, let's say from the extreme, by people who say you've gone too far too fast and you haven't held the tradition. So that the Mahdi sect who took over the Great Mosque in Mecca in 1979 is an example of that. And they still have those people to watch out for. So even the most conservative society is not immune from further extremism in that respect. Any other comments? Yeah.
Are there other times in history where technology has gone too fast or cultural changes have been made too fast and this kind of fundamentalism has risen?
Well, there certainly are no parallels to the 20th century in terms of the rapidity of social and economic change. There were analogous kinds of reform movements that happened, for example, when Islam first became encroached upon by the West in the 18th century, in the 19th century. Again, Muslims began to perceive something is going wrong. We used to always win, and now we're losing. There must be, therefore, a reason for this, and it may be that we've strayed from the path, and you see a variety of these kinds of reformist movements that date way back to the 18th and 19th century for Islam. The same thing, for example, happened in India to Hinduism in the 19th century. When the British took over, Hindus of various classes again felt that maybe part of our problem was the weakness of our society based on the form of Hinduism that had evolved. And that, again, maybe what we need to do is purify the faith of some of these added excesses. And so you have Hindu reform movements in the 19th century which are quite parallel to creating kind of Protestant churches within Hinduism. Elimination of idol worship, elimination of caste barriers, elimination of a number of these things that Christian missionaries would criticize and say, but now, see, we also have this very deep philosophy which, although we talk about these myriad millions of gods, they actually are manifestations of the one. And that's where some strong emphasis in Hindu philosophy that stressed the ultimate union of things became pushed by these people as a response. So yes, I think that there are other times in which changes introduced into the society have provoked those kinds of reform movements, but the pace and the rapidity of that have probably never been equaled compared to this time.
I hardly know how to ask this question, but do theologians deal with the question of what you do with a God who seems to be the reason why people kill one another?
Well, I'm glad we have a theologian in the room.
Oh, sure.
That's the talk. This is your session.
That's the forum here. What would you say? Is that something that is commonly discussed problem from a theological perspective?
Sure. I mean, I think it's usually discussed under the whole heading. In fact, I'm going to talk about it next week under the whole notion of what are our understandings of God with regard to determinism, fatalism, over against a God who may change, and concepts of freedom and will within God. And what is it falls under the big area of simply what is God's will, and how do we as human beings discern God's will?
Yeah. I don't know if this were would be true or not, but the way in which these movements manifest themselves, it seems to me often that it's a God of justice who is being invoked rather than a God of love and devotion and compassion. You know, it's the external projection of divine power into society.
Legalism,
and you know what's fair, what's just according to the divine order of things, seems to get stressed far more than the converse, the introspective God is within me kind of thing. Even in religions that have strongly emphasized that, doesn't seem to manifest itself very much in fundamentalism. Or these politically active groups that are now. That's the case of maybe failing to embrace the contraries to the proper balance.
Yeah, I guess I would say one more thing there too, in terms of it's important also to distinguish between justice and order at that point.
Okay.
And I think more importantly, the God of order is invoked. And within Christian circles, we see the argument coming theologically in terms of orders of creation. The reason things are going wrong is because God didn't make things that way, and because God didn't make things that way, therefore, you see, this is wrong. We've got to get back to the right order. And that can often be used to suppress or dominate things. You know, for example, one used to hear, not as much anymore, but it's still there to say, well, you see, because God didn't create homosexuals, and they're against the orders of creation, now AIDS is the punishment for that. It's a very orderly setup. Or at the time of abolition within the United States, as slavery, you could see, well, the curse of Canaan was used in terms of God's order was such that blacks are to be the servants of whites. That's God's order. That's the way God created it. So who are we to fight against slavery?
Right. And the people who then invoke that pattern, of course, see that as just.
Right.
That is the equivalent of justice.
And
you make a good distinction there. And that's what I think when they're stressing justice, it is meaning what you're saying by order there.
By order.
Right. Yeah. One of the other obvious factors, though it has some interesting permutations, is of course that you frequently need the presence of unassimilatable religious minorities for this to happen. And these religious minorities may be unassimilated by their own choice as much as by the decision of majority communities that they've traditionally tried to preserve their way of life, etc. But this tends to make them, as the Jews discovered tragically throughout much of their history in Western Europe, it makes them handy scapegoats for when things go wrong. It makes them targets for rumor, for calumny of all sorts. And because there's not much mixing between the communities, that may be because of marriage practices, other social practices, inner dining being prohibited and so forth, this cuts down the number of opportunities within a society that this group has of meeting and interacting as human beings with other members. And the result sometimes then is quite tragic. If things in the society then deteriorate, they become lightning rods for that kind of discontent. interestingly enough, one of those times is not just when the minority is oppressed and then they rise up, but sometimes it's when the minority is perceived to be too prosperous, is perceived to be benefiting too greatly compared to the others. In other words, when there's a disparity in socioeconomic status, which seems to be correlated with different religious groups within the society, that's a very volatile situation, in which then whichever group is below may invoke their religion as a way of creating a new just order, a way of remedying the situation and proclaiming that the religion is what sanctifies that particular transfer of power, monopoly of privilege. Certainly then you can link the outbreak of these things very frequently with either traumatic single events or with gradual economic declines. You don't need a single thing to turn it off, but oftentimes that will be it, because either of those things could be again used as evidence of God's displeasure with the way in which the society is behaving, and can then be brought forward as a reason for changing things drastically. Although we've been talking about violence, not all of this revivalism is automatically going to lead to violence. The means chosen by these groups, once they perceive this crisis situation, whether it's decline or that's gradual or this minority has more than we do or whatever, they may approach the problem in different ways, but it probably depends upon their particular position within the society. If they are the majority and there are institutional means in the political system for making changes, there may be no necessity for this to break out into violence, for them to affect their revolution. That seems to be happening, for example, in Malaysia, where they are gradually instituting more and more Islamic kinds of behavior on the whole society, including affecting the minorities, but are doing this without having to take up arms to do it, because they have the mechanism in both the political structure, that is, there are elected officials who have to respond, and they have the votes in terms of the majority to be able to do this.
So is it U.S. fundamentalism in the same position?
Yeah. The problem with them is we have absolutely no tradition of extra-legal means of achieving power, so they have to work within the system, but they are hoping that they can mobilize a majority to do that. Yeah, one glaring exception. Yeah.
Now, I noticed in the Maldives, for instance, recently, Gaddafi has been pouring a lot of money into a new, beautiful new mosque in Mali. And at the time we were there about 5 years ago, all of the Maldivians could no longer work in the resorts and serve liquor. So they were bringing in Indians to do that. Various of the laws were tightening up in the Maldives while we were there, and attempts by Gaddafi and Saudi and others to bring them under a stricter Islamic rule. They're doing it from that.
That's an interesting phenomenon too, which is analogous, of course, to the way in which we traditionally manipulated aid in the 50s and 60s. There's a price to be paid for this, and if you as a government are in need of some kind of economic assistance, sometimes there is a string or two attached. And what the oil-rich conservative Islamic societies have been able to do is tie that kind of a string to it, as opposed to joining CETO or something else that we may have required of people in the 50s for our anti-communist alliance system or some such thing. It's an interesting sidelight, because that's the small group of third world countries that have the financial capacity to use those kinds of incentives that others don't. That's a good example. What are the circumstances then when violence will break out? Probably two that I can think of. One would be when there is no mechanism in the political system for any group that dissents to be able to express that dissent and to change the government's mind in any way. Authoritarian states. And the Middle East is full of these kinds of states, which are ruled by either elites or monarchs or military dictatorships, which have never been responsive to public opinion in one fashion or other, and so the only avenue that people have is an extra legal one. The other is in places where the mechanisms are there, they may not be available to minorities who have very little hope of using the system to accomplish their goals. Those of you who were here yesterday for the Sri Lankan one, about the Sinhalese have used a democracy with one man, one vote to essentially impose their vision of the society on the minorities. So what can the minorities do? The mechanism is theoretically there for changing, but if the majority decides not to take minority rights or religious attitudes or anything else into consideration, then their only option again is to opt for violence and extra legal means, guerrilla movements and other terrorism, other kinds of things, traditional ways in which a relatively small handful of people can at least make the statement and possibly put pressure on authorities who seem unresponsive in any other way.
Our country is probably the best example in the world of that sort of scenario.
In what respect? You want
to
elaborate there?
In respect to a democratic type of government that has withheld rights from women and from minorities, particularly blacks, throughout our history. We've done it through legal means, right through the Supreme Court on down to Native Americans. You know, we can go on and on.
And our foreign policy is based upon a definition of democracy, which in many countries means simply an authoritarian, repressive...
Well, yeah. In fact, the definition probably traditionally been anti-communist,
right,
rather than than even defined
but positively. Even when you say free elections, free expression,
yeah,
and the very thing that you're talking about in Sri Lanka exists in those countries, like El Salvador. You know, you don't truly have a democracy. You just have two of the presumed traits of democracy.
Yeah. The sad thing, I guess, about the fact that when these groups have no recourse other than violence is that it's like letting the genie out of the bottle. What also seems to be a pattern in many of these movements, once those kinds of extra legal means have been taken, is that the most extreme elements in the movement gain control. Even if they don't represent the majority of the people who were protesting in the first place, they become able to dictate the agenda, to shape the situation. Everyone has to react to them. The examples seem clear, from Lebanon to the Punjab to Sri Lanka to the IRA, whatever. Moderates are often silenced by intimidation or, in many cases, eliminated. In many cases, in all of those places that I mentioned, the people who have killed Shiite leaders in Lebanon were more extreme Shias, or Sikh leaders in the Punjab were more extreme Sikhs, etc., who, because these leaders were now contemplating the possibility of compromise once the movement had started with the government, are now denounced as sellouts, as traitors, and once, as I said, the genie of violence is out, those people can, a single bullet takes people out.
The sad thing is
that
we all cry out for moderation, yet in my perception, history moves in extremes, and through moderation, we can't seem to get a recycling program or stop the dam on this river. It takes extremism.
Mm.
And that is a sad thing, that it takes this sort of overreaction to, which again causes another overreaction. California is a great example.
Big pendulum swings.
Never swings too much in the middle. You go from the Browns to Reagan, and it's part of history, I guess.
Yeah. Often concessions, which if they were made to these groups early on, which were at that time seen as extreme, become seen as moderate as the escalation increases. And then when those concessions are made, they're no longer enough. And then it's pushed far beyond that. The Sikhs wanting a certain degree of autonomy at first, and then now the only thing that certain will settle for is an absolutely independent state. And they will kill any Sikh who talks about settling for autonomy, this small group. So that those handful of extremists, as I say, tend to wind up dictating the situation. And in some ways, it's a deliberate, calculated strategy. They want to polarize the situation. They want, because what that does is it drives people to their extreme. If they can provoke enough reaction on behalf of the authorities, that will alienate more and more of their members, and they will be driven to more extremist positions themselves. And unfortunately, I mean, I see that in a number of these religious conflicts that aren't settled soon, whether you're talking about Northern Ireland or Sri Lanka, Punjab, Lebanon, others. This is something to keep in mind, I think.
What Carol said about Israel.
Yeah, Israel is moving the same direction here.
They will not compromise.
That's right, and the religious right in Israel is becoming stronger, and the settlers often take actions which polarize the situation even further. Exactly, and so what tends to happen, if that's the pattern, that the longer it goes on, it becomes more polarized. When we see these movements beginning in other places, it's probably very important to see what accommodation the authorities make to them. Can they make gracefully certain kinds of concessions which will make these groups feel more comfortable, feel that they have a mechanism and a choice in which they can shape the society the way they want? If they don't, then one feels that the long-range scenario gets progressively worse, and one would hope that governments begin to see that from the pattern that has been evolving over the last 10, 15 years with these movements. But there are other kinds in which, such as the Sri Lankan one, in which the majority, refuses to acknowledge these kinds of concessions because it feels that their whole identity will be ruined if they do. So then it becomes tragic. Any other comments?
How is North Ireland ever going to be settled? If enough of the children that come over here grow up, maybe it will.
Yeah. That's you also point up another problem. Once this becomes a polarized situation, is that whole generations grow up with a culture which is
Minneapolis
amazing.
Has every year Minneapolis has so many children coming over and living and then go back. I said if they can grow up, maybe it will start to change.
It's a good program, but it's only going to touch a relatively small number, and it's hard for people to resist peer pressure also when they go back, when that kind of thing occurs. I mean, it has a useful end in terms of what it does for the individuals for that time, but I'm not sure it's going to, in the long run, be instrumental in solving the conflict. Those generic factors that we've been talking about, the alienation that takes place as a result of rapid change is certainly something that's going to accelerate throughout the rest of the century and into the 21st. And so that will be, again, something that, you know, as I say, this core identity that people have in many parts of the third world with their religion as what has meant something important to them, and as they see that being eroded by these kinds of social and economic changes, there inevitably are going to have to be some kinds of revivals. Now, the form that those revivals take, I think, is still up in the air. We might get a new awakening kind of revival. It's, you know, something like a more spiritual revival in the late 18th century that would focus more on individual spirit life. But right now, the pattern that seems to be emerging right now, it seems to be the political fundamentalist type. I don't know.
In terms of just this notion of fundamentalism, and maybe you talked about this in a session I wasn't able to attend, but how would you define or describe fundamentalism in terms of enabling us to distinguish it from things like revival movements or reform movements? Or is fundamentalism synonymous with that? I mean, is Martin Luther the great reformer also Martin Luther the great fundamentalist? I mean, most of us, certainly I don't think of Luther as a fundamentalist. I think of him as a reformer. So I'm wondering, what would you see as a distinction between those two terms, if there is one? Maybe.
Yes. I have a lot of problems with the term fundamentalism, and I finally, you know, I wrestled with this. I'm probably not as carefully cautious about terminology as theologians would be, but what I caved in on here was that this has been used so widely in the popular press to describe these movements that I thought, well, if I'm going to label a title for a session out here, if people know what I'm going to be talking about, I'm better off talking about Islamic fundamentalism or Sikh fundamentalism or something like that rather than the other. I think it is far too loosely used. What it seems to connote in the way in which I see it used is it's applied to groups that seem to be looking backward to their model, not only in terms of this notion of ideas, but particularly in terms of a whole social-political pattern of life that would include even and especially seeming to stress some of these externals of that life as being indicative of godliness and being part of God's grace. It may mean in part doing some of the things that reformists do, which is going back to scriptures and getting key. But here again, we're frequently a reformer will be looking for a theological or a doctrinal justification for what might be perceived as modernizing change. The fundamentalists tend to see the modernizing change as the threat and to go back and look for a pattern of life which is the antithesis of that and adopt that as indicative of following God's pattern. Now that's kind of nebulous, but
excuse me, I'm still suffering with laryngitis. If you were talking about some very primitive third world countries, this would be seen as like a cargo cult. And it seems to me that a lot of fundamentalism seems to be an adjustment, a sociological or psychological thing, an adjustment movement, which is a reaction against too rapid change, probably on technological side, but other kinds of changes. And we saw that kind of thing happen. I was in New Guinea when cargo cult was coming back in. We saw that kind of thing in the Mau Mau uprising. Mm. We saw it in our own country with the ghost dancers in the Midwest. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that there's something about going just too far, and then somebody says, well, this is just too much, we've got to go back to this.
The brake, just dig in the brakes and the spurs and everything else, and everything has got to stop.
And so one of the ways you can sort of feel secure again is to go back to some former idyllic period of existence, and that might mean scriptures in an old-fashioned way. It might mean dress in an old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. Any number of societal rules.
Yeah.
So I see it kind of as an adjustment phenomenon. Mm-hmm.
And no doubt they see it a little differently than,
I'm sure they do.
Than others see it.
Yeah.
You know, others that don't consider themselves fundamentalists.
Yeah.
They see it as a way to be more pure, a closer relationship with God by going back to the blocking and tackling of the relationship rather than the fancy plays.
Yeah.
That he expressed himself in social economy.
Yeah, and I think it's the negative experience of change, too. We have to note that. I mean, it's whatever brings in negative aspects of change, then those are indications we've strayed from the path that made us happy. And the happy golden age in the past must have been, they didn't have any unhappy things.
Like Christians during the God is dead kind of thing, and everybody went crazy, especially people who weren't Christians went crazy.
Yeah. Okay, time is up. Lunchtime.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for your help.